It's a very special time in Yeshiva. The beginning of Adar. It's a time where after Tu Bishvat, we're ready. We've seen so many guys the sense of recognizing accomplishment after plugging away towards the beginning of the year and learning different things, learning more about ourselves and about learning and different challenges. It's a point in the year which already starts to pay off dividends, and we recognize more clearly our accomplishments and continue to charge forward towards Purim, towards the end of the Zman, towards a successful end of the Zman. Rabbi Benovitz may recall back from his YU days, my grandfather, Rav David Lifshitz, at the beginning of Adar every year, for many years, used to push what he called a Hasmada campaign. At the beginning of Adar, and he used to have these signs put up all over YU. I understand they've still put up. That guy's held on. That's a Mayom Azah. A sign, Mishanichnas Adar, Marve Mesimcha, Ve'ein Simcha Ella B'Torah, Ve'kol HaMarve HaRezim Meshubach. A time of moving things into high gear, greater clarity, greater focus, and together with that is a simcha that comes from accomplishment, a simcha that comes from productivity. And it's so appropriate at this time of year that we have with us one of the most talented, successful mechanchim that many of you know from experience, for those of you who have been in NCSY Kolo, and he continues the whole year in his Avodat HaKodesh in Reshit. Really, mechanech par excellence, who is enabling guys in different situations to maximize their potential, continue to grow as B'nai Torah, and help them to find within themselves that simcha that comes through productivity. It's a great privilege that we have with us today, Harav Benovitz.
You have to do me one favor, which is to grab onto, listen, take in every word that Rav Waxman just mentioned of the first part of the introduction, and to ignore every part of the second part of the introduction, the second half of the introduction. That part, I'll prove to you in a minute, is not relevant or is not true. But the first part, the first part that he mentioned is most certainly true. In fact, it's what I was going to begin with. I have a tremendous sense, not of a karsa tov even, a sense of mission, of being here tonight as part, on a very, very selfish and personal level, as part of my preparations, and it's something I hope that we can share together for the very meaningful days ahead, next week, and throughout the Chodesh Adar that we're going to celebrate and we're going to be part of together. There are two, really, maybe even three, distinct and important elements of that preparation that I feel we are uniquely capable of achieving together here tonight and as part of the context of being in yeshiva. First of all, we know that it's a time of Lech Kenos Kol Ayudim. If there's ever a time, Shalach Manos and Matanos Levyonim, if there's ever a time to come together, if there's ever a time to remind ourselves of Dibuch Chaverim, if there's a time just to wish a Shalom Aleichem to a person you haven't seen in a while and to reconnect with very, very good and meaningful friends, this is that time. This is the right time to do that. This is an opportunity to be together with each other and to come together, not to stay in your own Dalet Amos. So it's worth a drive of a few minutes, and it's certainly worth time together. To me, that Shalom Aleichem and that opportunity to say hello to everybody, and especially in this context, to see how incredibly everybody is doing. It's on your faces. It's in the energy in the room. It's already meaningful, and it's already a kiyum on that level of the preparations for Purim. And on a much deeper level, I think, and probably on a more important level, you will find that there is a fundamental connection between the Beis Medrash and the world of Torah, the yeshiva that you've been so immersed in over the past few months, and the celebration of Purim that we are going to have. We know that there is a correlation, sometimes and sometimes not, between the overall general calendar of the Jewish year and the way we spend our times in yeshiva. Sometimes that calendar correlates beautifully and perfectly. Sometimes it correlates a little bit less perfectly. The ways that it's not aligned, so one could argue on this, but Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, I've had the occasion many times to speak here in Chodesh Elul and to speak here at the beginning of the year. It's a little bit strange that the most intense, holiest day of the year is right after we get off the plane. Many people here, Shana Aleph, and I'm sure you came in very, very fine and very, very excited and with wonderful sense of appreciation and great midos and character and desire to learn and hasmada, but you're probably at a different point now than you were then and probably would appreciate and get more out of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur now than you might have at the very beginning of the year. Sometimes, and especially if you're teaching in a yeshiva that is not on the level necessarily of a place like Shalvim, and you're talking about with people just off the plane and really have very little appreciation for Beis Medrash, for Talmud Torah, it's a strange time for Ne'ilah. We can make a joke about it that it's, you know, you need Kapara right there, it's the best time to kind of cleanse the slate, and people have made that joke for many, many years and decades, and why is Rosh Hashanah after summer vacation and all that, and okay, it's nice as a joke, and maybe there's some truth to it, although I doubt there's very much. It's a time where it doesn't correlate perfectly. In a little over a month, we'll have a time which at least on the surface correlates least well. The fact that Pesach and the Seder are associated and match so perfectly with vacation and the freedom of Bein Hazmanim, that's a little bit strange. Pesach should be during the yeshiva time. Pesach should be the highlight. Again, a Seder in the family or a Seder in yeshiva, that's a debatable issue. But Pesach should be a time, not that the time where a person is struggling with the challenges of a Yerida and the challenges of being home for Pesach itself. The yeshiva calendar makes so little sense. We go the opposite direction of Aliyah L'Regel. I'm sure some of you will be fortunate enough to stay here through Nisan, and I'm not suggesting that if it's up to you and you had all the opportunities in the world that you shouldn't go home for Pesach. There's value in going home for Pesach, and there's value for taking a break and using Bein Hazmanim, but the Pesach Aliyah L'Regel experience being spent in Miami, Woodmere, or Los Angeles, it's a little bit strange. It's a little bit counterintuitive. It doesn't match up perfectly. Shavuos, on the other hand, again, very quickly. So Shavuos, towards the end of the Zman Matan Torah Seinu, and a celebration. It's a really good time of the year to have all-night learning in the Beis Medrash, especially in the American style of yeshivos, where the Zman ends even closer to the end of Shavuos. It really makes sense. It's a kind of culmination of a year of learning. And I would argue that the Chag that fits most perfectly with our clocks and with our schedule is Purim. The fact that we have, exactly as Waxman mentioned, the fact that we have the culmination of the time spent in Beis Medrash being spent in learning, the fact that there is a perfect transition and flow from the Torah that we learn to the way which we celebrate and what we celebrate on Purim, I think that's exceedingly meaningful. And the more that we can strengthen that connection, the better off we are going to be. The Bayamim Ahem Bazman Hazeh that we are referring to is not only a description of the Nisim and Niflos that we are privileged to experience on a regular basis in our lives. It doesn't mean that the hand of God and the Hashkacha and the Nisim, whether they're Geluyim or Nistarim, the Nisim that took place in Shushan in the time of Purim are also taking place in battlefields in Gaza and in other situations for the Jewish community Bazman Hazeh. There is a much more direct application of Bayamim Ahem Bazman Hazeh. It means the miracles that took place then are being reflected in the lives that we are leading now. They were done so that we can be the beneficiaries, so that we are the people, the Kimu V'Kiblu. The entire narrative arc of the story of Purim is being fulfilled and is ongoing today. It is not something that happened then and is irrelevant to the Gemara, to the Masechtas, to the Siddurim that we're having right now, but there is a fundamental connection, both in terms of the Hachanos leading up to the day of Purim and in terms of what Purim is meant to represent and it's what meant to be. As long as there's a disconnect, if there's any activity and any decision that we make, any experience that we have on Purim that seems utterly removed and in a different world from the Torah that we're learning and the Beis Medrash that we spend so much of our time in, that's probably an indication that it's a mistake. It doesn't mean that our activities, our behaviors on Purim are meant to be identical to our activities and behaviors on Yud Dalet Shvat or Yud Dalet Teves, but it means there has to be a thread that connects them. There has to be a flow, there has to be an interaction between them. And again, the more time you spend in yeshiva, from the Beis Medrash to the Chagiga, from the Beis Medrash to the Suda, is one of the greatest transitions, one of the greatest walks you'll ever be able to make, if it's a walk at all. I'll assume, is the Chagiga here in the Beis Medrash over here? in the dining room. Okay? So it's at least it's in yeshiva grounds in a makom Torah of sorts. I hope, and again, I don't know one way or the other, but some people say, well, a beis medrash is no place for what goes on with a chagiga. You wouldn't want, I would never imagine that that's the case here, and it shouldn't be the case in too many places. The fact that, again, in a makom Torah, you are celebrating on Purim, and the way that you're celebrating on Purim is as good an indication as anything else. And finally, just by way of introduction, I must say on a very, very personal level, I think I've mentioned it to him before, but my kids all know that we have a very, very varied playlist from Uncle Maishi and kids songs to much more sophisticated Jewish music around the year in the car. But on Rosh Chodesh Adar, I referenced Lech Kenos before, but Rav Waxman's Niggun and Lech Kenos is played on an endless loop in our car from Rosh Chodesh Adar until minimally Shushan Purim, and all my kids know it by heart, and it's an enormous part of our Hachanos. To be able to take part in Hachanos for Purim here in Shalvim is a very, very special privilege. It's a massive responsibility that I don't take lightly. This is headquarters for Purim preparation, and has been by extension with Rav Waxman, with his unbelievable help and talents, has been the extended headquarters of preparation in the Benevitz home and the Benevitz car for a number of years. So it's great to be able to, at least on some small level, try to repay that favor. One of the things we sometimes miss out on doing in our preparations for Purim is Purim is not always the time, and I mean outside of this context, exactly as I just described, Purim's not always the time for thinking deeply about things, and not always the time. We tend to get lost in a sense of a holiness, chas v'shalom, and instead of thinking in the deepest levels, we tend to look at things on a superficial level. This comes to many of the descriptions we have about Purim itself. We all know, and many times have sang, and the more catchy the jingle, and the more times we sing it, so very often we lose the meaning and significance, but everybody is familiar with the concept of Mishenichnas Adar Marbim Besimcha. Many of us, undoubtedly, are familiar with a variety of explanations of what the Riboy Simcha really is. What is it a tzivoy of Riboy Simcha? How does one fulfill, and how does one connect on any meaningful level to an increase in Simcha, an abundance of Simcha that's associated with Adar? Fewer people, although I'm sure most everybody here is familiar, with the source of that statement. It is not Rav Nachman Breslov. It is not a modern invention of just be happy. It's not, Bobby McFerrin. It's not, don't worry, or newer happy songs that you could use as a reference over there. It's not any of that, but it comes from the Gemara itself. The Gemara itself in Maseches Tanis is the place where we receive these instructions of Mishenichnas Adar Marbim Besimcha. However, the context of that Gemara, which we will return to many times over the course of our few minutes together tonight, the context of that Gemara is exceptionally bizarre and very, very surprising. Both the wording and the context of that Gemara is strange. The Gemara Maseches Tanis on Daf Chav Tes makes the statement that Kishem, just like Mishenichnas Av, Mimatim Besimcha, Kach Mishenichnas Adar, Marbim Besimcha. The Gemara makes a statement that just like in the period of Av, we decrease our Simcha, it's a source of great pride, even if the context is not altogether wonderful. Av and Adar have a fundamental connection with so many of us in this room. We've spent many an Av together. I've sat on the floor with a good number of you during the month of Av, during the end of Tammuz, on Shivas of Tammuz, and on the plaza of the Kotel, on Tisha B'Av itself, in the Beis Medrash and Beit Meir, and wherever you are. We've sat together as Jews, even if we don't know each other, and even if you were in Camp Morashah, or if you were at home in your home shul, we've sat together. We know what it means to experience the miut of Simcha, of Av, and the Gemara says, just like there is the limit of Simcha in Av, so too is there an increase of Simcha in Adar. First and foremost, it is noteworthy, and we will see in a few moments exactly how noteworthy it is. It is noteworthy that the Gemara puts the Simcha of Adar specifically in the context of Chodesh Av. That it links those two when you would think that they are diametrically opposed and as opposite can be. But second of all, and more specifically, the phrasing of the Gemara is exceptionally strange. The Gemara uses a statement which on the surface seems to be outright false. It should have, in comparing, in putting side by side Av and Adar, the connecting word should have been a word of contrast. As opposed to Av, where we limit Simcha, in Adar, we increase Simcha. The word kishem seems wildly and inappropriately out of place in this context. Just like there is sadness in Av, just like there is a limit and a restriction on joy in Av, so too there is an abundance of simcha in Adar. It's a very, very strange statement to make. On a simple pshat level, and I believe there is certainly merit to this, we can close our books and go home, but there is a simple explanation that the Gemara, of course, and this is significant not only for the way in which it answers the question, but for what it represents and what it teaches us about both Av and Adar, and specifically the Simcha of Adar, that Simcha and the Miut Simcha are not blank slates. There are specific ways and specific implications of this Simcha. The Gemara goes on to state, it's not made into a song, so we're all less familiar with it, although again, I'm sure everybody has heard of it. The Gemara goes on to state that the simcha elements, less in Av, more in Adar, manifest themselves primarily in a particular mazel, and a person who has dealings with a non-Jew should avoid those dealings in the early days of Av and pursue those dealings in Adar. Adar is a great month for Jewish victory, Av perhaps a little bit less so, and therefore in the application you have a sense of connection. The kishem is not on what you do, because what you do in fact is opposite, but it's in the how you do it. What it is that you do to fulfill the mi simcha and Av and the abundance of simcha and Adar is in fact the same, and that's what kishem means. Kishem doesn't mean that they're the same, because they're not. They are in fact opposites, but kishem means as opposites, they are treated on the same arena, namely the courtroom in which you're dealing with a non-Jew. And once again, the takeaway obviously is, as I said, that simcha doesn't mean whatever you want it to mean. That simcha, whether it's the Gemara's particular application or many other applications you may have heard or will learn about in the days to come about what simcha really is, and we'll touch upon that a very little bit, even if not explicitly, in a couple of minutes. But the very, very nature of simcha has definitions. It has an approach and a methodology, and is not a free-for-all for feeling good in any way we wish to do it. Even if this is the pshat or ape shot, it still seems to be a clumsy, perhaps awkward way for the Gemara to speak, which leaves us a little bit wrong. There are things that we can say which are true, but we still wouldn't feel comfortable saying them all the time. If you have a connection, if you remember, you have a mass gathering at a Siyum HaShas, and you say this is exactly like Rav Elyashiv's funeral. It's not exactly like that. I know what you mean. You mean that the last time there was such a mass gathering of Jews in such a particular focused way was the funeral, the Levaya of Ravadi Yosef, the Levaya of Rav Elyashiv. You're not saying anything offensive, but to say this is just like that, even if there is some truth to the statement, and we all know what you meant, seems to be a little bit of a weird way to talk. And once again, we would seek out contrast where in fact there is a sense of connection there. There is, and I mentioned this almost in passing, we'll try to say it as quickly as possible, we're going to try to get as many ideas in as we can in the minutes that we have. There's a remarkable sefer that some of you may be familiar with, Rav Karelenstein, and he has essays on Hanukkah, essays on Purim. So he has a very, very creative answer to this problem, which clearly could be its own entire topic and conversation, but we'll save that for a different time. I'll just mention it to you very, very quickly. According to Rav Karelenstein, the kishem refers to a different dimension of Adar and Av entirely. Why is it, asks Rav Karelenstein, well, before we get to the why is it, let's get to the what is it. Rav Karelenstein says that there is another point of connection between Av and Adar, besides the fact that they both revolve around Simcha in opposite directions. That is, generally speaking, we have Yomim Tovim, and we have days, and we may even have a week of special focus on different ideas, but that does not naturally and automatically extend to larger periods of time besides the Chag. We, for example, begin to speak about and begin to prepare for Sukkot immediately after Yom Kippur, but Sukkot is more than Purim, Zaman Simchaseinu. While there may be no tachnun, and that's for other reasons, we do not have a notion of v'samachta b'chagecha on Yud Beis Tishrei. We don't engage in this, and there's no Simchas Beis HaShoeva, there's no preview of the Simchas Beis HaShoeva before Sukkot starts. There are but two times where an entire period, yes, there is Elul, where we engage in tshuva. That's more of, like I said, the hachanas for it. But an entire period being colored by the chagas in the middle is most strongly felt in Av, the 3 weeks, and much more importantly, halachically, much more intensely halachically, the 9 days that begin mishenichnas Av, the onset of Av is really the kickoff for Tisha B'Av itself. The 9 days and the restrictions and the Avelus begin earlier, and we also engage in that in Adar as well. It's the kishem is on the mishenichnas part. The fact that we don't just say that Purim is happy in the same way that Tisha B'Av is sad, we're not talking about the emotion, we're talking about the calendar. Kishem shem mishenichnas av, the same way that Tisha B'Av extends 9 days earlier than it naturally should, so too Adar extends 15 days earlier, 14 days earlier than it naturally should. And of course, Rav Karelenstein asked, as I foreshadowed a moment ago, why is that the case? Why, in fact, isn't there a Mishenichnas Tishrei, or at the very least, Mishenichnas Yud Aleph Tishrei? I understand we're focused on Yomim Noraim, on the Aseres Yimei Tshuva, up until Ne'ilah, up until Maariv after Yom Kippur. But that minute when we start hammering away at the Sukkah, why don't we say Mishenichnas Yud Aleph Tishrei, Marbim B'Simcha? Why don't we say Mishenichnas Nisan, Marbim B'Simcha? There's a Chi of Simcha stronger than the Chi of Simcha on Purim, a Mid D'Oraisa, according to virtually all Rishonim. A D'Oraisa Chi of Simcha on Pesach, that starts on Pesach. Why don't we say Mishenichnas Nisan, Marbim B'Simcha, Mishenichnas Sivan, Marbim B'Simcha? So to this, Rav Karelenstein explains so beautifully and so insightfully that Adar itself is a chelek gadol, a significant component of the miracle of Purim. That if you read the Megillah, up to and including the name of Purim itself, Hu HaGorol, it has to do with the lottery that Haman engages in order to determine an opportune time. So what was Haman rooting for? Ask Rav Karelenstein. It could have been any date on the calendar, and there's no doubt he wasn't overjoyed about having to wait 12 months in order to execute his terrible plan. What were the months, though, that he would have thought are really, really good outcomes? Well, of course, Av would have been a good one. What are the other downer months? He knows he doesn't want it to be in Nisan. Nisan is the month of liberation, the month of Geula. Tishrei is also a pretty good, auspicious time for Jews. And again, there'll be a couple of others that you might wonder about, but what are the months that he wants least? What are the months? What is the month that he wants most? Excuse me. What are the months that are going to be most excited? So generally speaking, we have 2 months on the calendar, maybe three if you count Iyar and Sfiras Omer and the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. But prior to that, you have 2 months on the calendar, on our calendar, that are associated with elements of sorrow. You have Av and you have Cheshvan. We call Cheshvan Mar Cheshvan because it is a dark month devoid of Yomim Tovim. Prior to Purim, explains Rav Karelenstein, Adar was Mar Adar. Adar was the month, the last month of the year, and Adar was, you don't want to use the word like the loser month, but Adar was the month that was like a throwaway. And Adar was a month, we know famously about the confusion Haman has about the death of Moshe Rabbeinu and the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu. Rav Karelenstein says this is a much deeper concept and a much deeper idea. Adar was the month Haman was jumping for joy when it came to Adar. Adar was the month that can't be the month of success. Adar is not the month of Geula. Adar is the month that you reject. Adar is the Even Ma'asu Habanim. It's the Mi'us month. It's the month of rejection. It's the month of failure. It's the month of the end. It's the month that is the darkest before the dawn. But the dawn is not Adar. The dawn is Nisan. The dawn is for the heroic spring. The dawn is for the bright, bright days ahead. Adar itself is dark. Adar is the end. Adar is depression. Adar is lack of hope. That's what Adar represents. Mishenichnas Adar Marvim B'Simcha means that one of the definitions of Simcha is that the entire month was transformed. The Simcha of Purim is the Simcha of transformation from hopeless to hopeful, from no chance to big chance, from failure to success. The transformation of the month of Adar from being the tail end of the year and the last month where good things happen and the darkest moments before the dawn, that's the transformation of Purim. The underdog's victory and the fact that you could have success. And I think it goes so beautifully with what Rav Waxman mentioned in the introduction, which, like I said, I can only echo and say how exciting it is to hear it from him and how much of a chizik it should be for all of us. And it connects to what we started with in terms of the calendar, that Purim is a chag of accomplishment of during the year. Every Adar of our life, every area of our life, our Limud Gemara, the focus that we have on davening, some of the Dibur Chaverim, any area in our life where we struggled in, where we didn't necessarily see Hatzlacha, and we worked, and we were able to transform an area of weakness into an area of greatness, that's Mibchina's success of Adar. That's the Simcha of Adar. That's the great accomplishment that we celebrate. That's an enormous part of what the Purim celebration is supposed to be. I'm obligated by law to give a sports analogy. I was actually thinking about how I wasn't going to, and I didn't have a very good one, but it just, on this very point that Kurlensky mentioned, it's not in the Sefer, believe it or not, but it's true. Everybody knows the most iconic swing of your lifetime is Derek Jeter's inside-outside swing. He swings like nobody else. That swing where he brings the bat very close, and what you call in baseball an inside-outside swing. When you think of Derek Jeter, you think about him hitting the ball the opposite way and having that swing, like I said, bring it very close to his body. I remember in 1995, 1996, when Derek Jeter was a rookie. He had great poise and he had great maturity. He was a fantastic hitter and a very, very heady player. He then in those days had good range at shortstop. But the scouting report, and you did not need to be a professional scout, you just needed to watch three Yankee games. The scouting report was that he was incapable of hitting a pitch that was high and inside. All you had to do was find that sweet spot in the strike zone, a little bit high and a little bit inside, and Derek Jeter couldn't hit it. The reason why he's the most legendary Yankee of this generation is because instead of saying, look, I'm Derek Jeter, I'm good at X, Y, and Z, and I stink at A, B, and C, so I'll focus on X, Y, and Z and celebrate my many, many accomplishments in that area, he said, no, it actually became his greatest strength. It became Lahavdil, his Chodesh Adar. The darkest place, the hole in his swing, became his greatest strength and the iconic image of what he's able to do. If Kurelenstein writes, and this he does write, this is the Simcha of Adar. This is the Simcha of the transformation of the dark Chodesh to something greater. I want to share with you, however, tonight, a different insight. One that I believe has for all of us, and for what some of us together and some of us in our own different ways in different places have experienced as a nation over the past few months and really over the past year. All I could do for the next few minutes is share with you a thought or two of some truly remarkable Torahs, but they're specifically remarkable for me. I hope they will be for you. They speak to my heart, and I'm sharing with you what is on my mind as we attempt to generate genuine emotion and joy over the next few days and over the celebration of Purim. And I want to share you something, like I said, when we talk about an idea that's being deep, I can't tell you on a philosophical level and in the hallways of academia across the world how deep or shallow the ideas we're about to share are, but I can tell you that for me, that when I go and when I turn inward to the deepest places that I know how to get to, these are the things that I'm thinking about late at night and in the days leading up to Purim, and honestly, not just the days leading up to Purim, but in the entire progression of Chag and Simcha emanating from some of the challenges and the world that we've been a part of, especially here in Eretz Yisrael, over the past year, since Purim a year ago, including the difficulties and the incredible challenges and emotions, especially in this community, of last June and last Tammuz, including, of course, the struggles and challenges of the summer, and what's still continuing. It could be cute and humorous that the mayor gets involved in some type of vigilante heroism in a terrorist attack yesterday, and everybody's okay, and he was saying Tehillim at the Kotel, and it's kind of like a happy story and an other story, but it's a pachad. It's a pacha that in the streets of Yerushalayim, the streets that we walk on a general basis, there are still threats over our head. And we need to try to understand that specifically in the context that we're here right now. And many, many could suggest that that is included in the incredible depth and sophistication of the Gemara's terminology of kishem, the Gemara's terminology of the just like. Rav Chaim Friedlander, in one of his beautiful essays on Tisha B'Av and on the 3 weeks, presents this concept, or at least the beginning of this concept. He presents this concept beautifully in the context of some of the more, or one of the more well-known kinos of Tisha B'Av. On Tisha B'Av, we describe, it's towards the end of kinos, it's a song, so everybody knows it. We have the kino of B'tzeisi Mirushalayim, B'tzeisi Mimitzrayim. It is a song that has a high part and a low part, a loud part and a soft part, a loud part and a quiet part. And it is a song, much like the Gemara should have been that we quoted, it is a song on the surface of contrast. That the Jewish people have highs and lows, and they are meant to be contrasted in every single aspect, one to the other. The joyous songs of B'tzeisim and Mitzrayim, Oz Yashir Moshe, Shiras Hayam, the triumphant march through the desert over the Yarden and into Eretz Yisrael, and the much, much slower, depressing march, Al Naharos Bavel, the elegies and kinos of Yirmiyah as we left Yerushalayim. B'tzeisim and Mitzrayim, triumphant Jews, successful Jews, B'tzeisim mi Yerushalayim. And if you had to describe, summarize this song into a single word, as I mentioned a moment ago, the word would be contrast. We have different experiences in our life, experiences of joy, experiences of tragedy, and the kina highlights the contrast between them. Rav Friedlander suggests on a musical level, on a poetic level, and much more important on a philosophical level, if you believe that the song is there to contrast, you're missing the point entirely. According to Rav Friedlander, it is a song of equation. The same hashgacha, and this is his point of focus, which we will expand upon in a moment, the same hashgacha that leads to the celebration and the joy, B'tzeisi Mimitzrayim, Yitzias Mitzrayim, and Knisa to Eretz Yisrael, is the same hashgacha and in the same master plan of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that is part and parcel of B'tzeisi Mimitzrayim. There is not meant to be contrast, but in other words, according to Rav Friedlander, this kina, B'tzeisi Mirushalayim, B'tzeisi Mimitzrayim, this kina is an articulation of the famous statement of Chazal in the Gemara Brachos, the Mishnayos in Brachos, Kishem Shemivarchem Alatov, Mivarchem Alhara, that there is a bracha, Baruch Dayan HaEmes, to contrast Hatov HaMeitiv, to contrast Shechianu, a bracha that we recite no matter what HaKadosh Baruch Hu does to us. That there is a common denominator, that the Avelus of Av is connected to the Simcha of Adar, or in the case of the Kina, the Simcha of Pesach there. There's a, I remember, I attended Breuer's Elementary School. And at the time that I was in Breuer's, Rav Schwab was still alive. Rav Schwab, the great leader of the Breuer's community in Washington Heights, he was still living in Washington Heights. He was still living the Breuer's community in Washington Heights. And it's a tragedy, a tragedy of my life, that when I was in elementary school, that meant next to nothing to me. They took us about twice a year, once every 3 or 4 months, they would take classes to Rav Schwab's house on Thursday afternoon for private audience with Rav Schwab. Probably started like in the 3rd or 4th grade and continued to the 8th grade. And even in the 8th grade, all it meant to me was 40 minutes out of class. I remember on Rav, again, this is not funny, this is embarrassing, and it's a source of enormous shame for me. But on if it was a Rav Schwab day, the preparations meant bringing a little racquetball, a little blue ball to school so that you could play ball on the way to Rav Schwab and maybe even hang out below the elevator, get a few extra minutes of handballing before the Rebbe would grab you by the back of the ear and bring you up to Rav Schwab. I didn't know who Rav Schwab was, and unfortunately I didn't care too much. From all of those sessions, I remember two things, one of which I'll tell you now, that Rav Schwab said to us. Rav Schwab said that he grew up with a very, very strict father, a very German, austere type of upbringing, and he remembers the two times that he felt closest to his father, the two times he felt the greatest connection. One was when he did something, he didn't go into the details in his great humility, but he described doing something very, very good, and his father was beaming with pride. His father was not very touchy, but his father embraced him at that moment, kissed him on the forehead, and he told him what a job well done, what a great job that he had done. There was another time, which he did go into detail for, and I will not, out of respect for Rav Schwab, but Rav Schwab did what he considered to be a little bit of a crime, a little bit of a mistake. He told his mother when he came home, his mother said, wait till your father gets home. Rav Schwab was terrified about what his father's reaction was going to be. He was cowering in his room, no reaction. His father doesn't come to him. And that Friday night, he thinks, okay, maybe he's forgiven me, maybe it's all okay. But after davening and right before Kiddush, they're lining up for a bracha from the father. And Rav Schwab said, for the tiniest of instances, his father turns away from him. His father, for the tiniest of seconds, hesitates before giving the bracha. And Rav Schwab described the searing pain of that moment of rejection, but simultaneously how that feeling of pain was the closest he ever felt to his father. The ability to generate that level of rejection and that level of frustration was the closest he felt to his father. This is a person whose closeness, whose approval, whose connection means something to me, and it is so present in its absence, if you can imagine such a thing. This is what Friedlander describes, B'tzeisi Mitzrayim, B'tzeisi Mirushalayim. That there is, what we absence makes the heart grow fonder, that there is a connection between the two. There is an even deeper connection to what Rav Friedlander describes. Please listen very, very carefully. As like I said, I share with you some things that are just floating around in my own mind, in my own emotions, and have been for many, many months. Because there is a deeper way of understanding this fundamental connection that Rav Friedlander establishes between the tragedies of Av and the joy of Adar. After all, listen carefully. There is a theme that is central to all that we do on Purim. It itself is a song, and that is the theme of Vinahafachu. Vinahafachu is translated as turnabout, a revolution, a way of things changing, like we spoke about in Rav Karelenstein's name, of changing from one to the other, a metamorphosis and a transition. I'd like to suggest to you, with the help of various Mefarshim commentaries that I'll share with you in a moment, I'd like to suggest to you that there is a variety of ways that the word lehafeich, v'nahafach, lehafoch, the way that word is used and what it means and what it represents. One of the more interesting ways that we find v'nahafachu is in connection to, and this should sound reminiscent right away of what we've been speaking about all evening, is in the connection between avelus and simcha on a very, very simple halachic level. The Gemara Maseches Moed Katan asks the question, on Daf Chaf Amud Aleph, the Gemara asks the question, why do we sit shiva? Where does the number 7 come as the appropriate period for avelus? The Gemara quotes a pasuk in Amos, "Dichsiv v'hafachti chagechem le'evel." HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises us, not promises us, threatens us, as it were, that there will be a time where the lack of Beis HaMikdash and the oppression that we are under is so severe and so intense that that which used to be joy will become evel. V'hafachti chagechem le'evel. I will transform your periods of joy into periods of sadness. There is a mirror image of 7 and 7 and a transformation from one to the other. A complete metamorphosis from good to bad. And you can fill in the blanks yourself. You imagine, sadly, tragically, many families who have withstood a terror attack or a terrible, terrible loss of a member of their families, they will describe in the most poignant and heartrending of ways how the most joyous times have become for them the most painful. We've experienced tragically such a reality in our communities and our nation. The things that I remember and associate with the greatest of emotions, the happiest of emotions, gets transformed into something, because of what's lacking, gets transformed into something much more negative. But there's something fascinating hinted to in the halachic works, something fascinating about that word, v'hafachti chagechem le'evel, and its real, real meaning. If you take a look in the Sifrei Halacha, there's a very, very bizarre halacha, and you all are familiar with the halacha. We don't like to ask too many questions about this particular halacha, therefore we don't think about it all that much. When you think about it for a minute, we think about how strange it is. The halacha tells us that in a Beis Avel, we do not recite Tachnun. This is considered to be, in most of our communities, a small incentive for the mitzvah of going to a Beis Avel. True, it's in a Beis Avel and a couple of extra kaddishes, but I don't get to say Tachnun. This is why, traditionally, Mondays and Thursdays are exceptionally popular days for a person to visit a Beis Avel. It's a really, really good time to do your mitzvah because there's no Tachnun. Okay, so like I said, type of halacha, we don't like, don't try to rock the boat. Don't ask too many questions, because if you ask too many questions, maybe somebody in authority is going to realize that that makes very, very little sense. We normally associate the lack of Tachnun with days, and this itself requires explanation. What is it in those paragraphs that is inconsistent with days of joy and days of meaning? Discussion for a different time. But we generally, maybe we're wrong, we generally associate lack of Tachnun with an increased level of Simcha. One would imagine that the very best place in the world to recite Tachnun is in a Beis Avel. Why on earth do we not recite Tachnun in a Beis Avel? What's wrong? What better place in the world is there for Nefilas Apayim than in a Beis Avel? Isn't that consistent with the themes of Avelos? Doesn't it go perfectly together? And again, no trying to rock the boat, but we do need an explanation. If you take a look at the Sifrei Halacha, if you take a look at the Nosei Kelim on the Shulchan Aruch, you will find that there are three answers given to that question. One answer that is suggested is that a Beis Avel is a very, very dangerous place to be. There is a strong sense of Midas HaDin hovering in every Beis Avel. There is a sakin munach al sabareinu. There is a knife poised to strike. It's already been there. It's a place where the Malach HaMaves, it's a place where the Midas HaDin has a foothold. And therefore, we're very, very careful about confessing our sins and excessive negativity. You want to share negativity, do it in a happier place or in a different context, but the stakes are very, very high in a Beis Avel. Okay, maybe, certainly makes a little bit of sense, even if it's not the type of lifestyle, the type of way we usually look at things, but maybe we should. Good. There's another answer that's given that actually speaks to me on a very deep level, but we know that tfilos in general tend to be klal oriented. However, confessionals, modim, and specifically tachnun, is a little bit more personal. And if we understand, and it's an assumption, but if we understand that tachnun is among the most personal of tefillos, then we can understand where going into our own world of nefilas apayim and personal confession is not appropriate in a Beis Avel. Your most personal of tefillos should be recited in a Beis Knesses or in your own yechidas. But in a place where the focus is on, I go into Daven Maariv with you in the Shalvim Beis Medrash, the focus is on, at most, the klal, and really on every individual in the klal. Nobody here lays claim to the spotlight in the Shalvim Beis Medrash. But in a Beis Avel, that's clearly not the case. The Avel is the star of the show. The Avel is the subject of the attention. And the personal tefillah of Tachnun and that level of confession is not appropriate for a Beis Avel. This is what some suggest. And others say no. Others say that it says in the Gemara, where does it come from that you sit Shiva for 7 days? It comes from Yom Tov. V'hafachti chagechem le'evel. Thus, explain some, that's the reason why there's no Tachnun in a Beis Avel. And many of the Nosei Kelim point out that is patently ridiculous. That is an absurd reading of the Gemara. The Gemara said, remember our word of the night, the Gemara said, v'hafachti. The Gemara said, I will transform, I will change, I will metamorphosize. There will be no more Avelos, there will only be Yom Tov. What does it mean to be lahafoch, to change? It means we're contrasting. That which was Yom Tov is now Avelos. The 7 and 7 is not meant to draw a bridge of connection. It's meant to be, like I said, that mirror image and that contrast. How do you take the Gemara, which describes such a depressing, negative nevuah of the hafachti chagechem le'evel, and to make it seem like that's the reason we don't say tachnun in a Beis Avel? That's exactly why we say tachnun in a Beis Avel. And the answer, it depends on the meaning of the word v'hafachti. It is clear from this suggestion that hafachti means, much like we spoke about in the context of the Gemara and Tanis, and much like Rav Chaim Friedlander says in the context of the Kinah, b'tseisim Yerushalayim, b'tseisim Mitzrayim, the Pasuk is describing a turnabout that does not obliterate the first side, but maintains it in the spirit of two sides of the same coin. There is a v'hafachti. The word is used in Tanakh and Sefer Bereishis in the context of Ir Sidon. That hafachti is a one-time shot where Sodom is overturned, destroyed, and the other side of Sodom will never be seen again. The word means to completely destroy, to change in a way that is irreversible now and forever. But that is not the only, that is not the first, and that is not the most important. Hey, pei chaf, hefech, not the first, only, or most important one that we have in Tanakh. The first time we encounter this word, and you don't need me to tell you the significance of the first time we find the word in Tanakh, the first time we find it is in the context of the sword that rotates at the gate of Gan Eden. The Cherev HaMisapeches. The Cherev HaMisapeches is not a revolution in the sense of a change that is once, now, and forever. It is the revolution of a constant rotation, of a world that is in flux, of a world that exists at all moments with two sides of a coin, a happy face and a sadder face, of tragedy and joy. V'hafachti chagichem le'evel means you will be in a constant state of flux where sometimes there is joy and sometimes there is sorrow, where they exist around each other all the time. And where you find joy, that somewhere beneath there looms, and we'll explain this in a moment, looms and lurks the potential for sorrow. And in a much more uplifting way, or at least directly uplifting way, when you have the greatest sorrow, you must know that beneath the surface lurks the new day that will revolve around, lurks the rotation, and the coming joy and nechama that is there for you. V'hafachti chagichem le'evel speaks to the Beis Avel and says that it is true. This Beis Avel is a moment of sorrow, but somewhere in our experience, not for today, it's the tiniest hint of a potential joy that will come around again. There is the most extraordinary insight of Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch into that very pasuk of the Cherev HaMisapeches. You need to listen to this carefully because the question is so extraordinary, and in one of those rare cases where as great as the question is, the answer is even better. Adam and Chava commit the most awful sin in Gan Eden, the original sin, the basis of half of Christian theology, and of course the Jewish people, it's our book. We understand the significance of the Chet HaRishon, the Chet of Adam and Chava, and it's a significant Chet. History is altered because of it. The punishments they receive, the difficulties in childbirth, it's an enormous, enormous game changer for Adam and Chava, and to make matters worse, the punishment of leaving Gan Eden is given to them as well. Adam and Chava are banished from paradise. Adam and Chava are banished from Gan Eden. And on their way out, in the final pasuk of Perek Gimel, HaKadosh Baruch Hu adds these elements. Vayigoresh es ha'adam, vayashkein mikedem, vayigoresh es ha'adam, esnachta. God divorces, separates, and banishes man from his homeland, from Gan Eden. Vayashkein mikedem le'Gan Eden. And he establishes east of Gan Eden es hakruvim v'es lahat hacherev hamisapeches. And he establishes kruvim, we just read about them in last week's parsha, and the cherev hamisapeches. He establishes kruvim, these cherub-like angels, and a rotating fiery sword. And why does he do that? L'shmur es derech etz hachayim, to make sure that man does not come back, to guard and protect Derech Eitz HaChayim. Ask Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch a few questions. First of all, why do you need two guards over there? What, couldn't one do the trick? Come to think of it, question number two. Kruvim are not the most intimidating. I mean, we don't know exactly what Kruvim are. Babies, angels. But they're not exactly the best bouncers you and I could imagine. I have a great stash of American chocolate bars. Maybe I've got some great deli that my parents brought for me, freeze-dried pack from America. I'm putting them in a corner of my room, and I'm putting my stuffed animal, Pillsbury Doughboy, in front to guard and make sure. I mean, again, that's not what the Kruvim are, obviously, but they're really weak at guarding the Derech Eitz HaChayim. Third of all, and perhaps most importantly, why do you need anything at all? Why do you need two? Why do you need Kruvim? And why do you need anything at all? In fact, centuries of human experience confirm the fact that we don't need anything at all. Says Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch, God could have just hidden and made the entrance to Gan Eden inaccessible exactly as he did. This is a completely insignificant precaution. There has not been an explorer, a merchant, a hiker who has stumbled across the gates of Gan Eden only to not be able to get in because there's a mini golf rotating sword that he can't time to crawl under in order to make it into Gan Eden before he punches the Kruvim in the stomach. It doesn't happen. It's never happened. How does God protect Gan Eden? He makes its entrance secret to the point that nobody could find it. So what's being described in this pasuk? Listen carefully to this. Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch says, the most extraordinary explanation. What does it mean, l'shmor es derech etz hachayim? What does it mean to guard the way to Gan Eden? That statement is a double entendre, says Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch. It could simultaneously mean two things that in this particular case are absolute opposites of one another. Surely it can be read, as most people read it, l'shmor es derech etz hachayim, to guard the entranceway and make sure nobody goes in. But equally easily, and in fact more accurately, says Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, the pasuk can be read to mean that he knows, as he banishes Adam and Chava, that you and I, all of our ancestors and all of our offspring, will spend a lifetime trying to find our way back to Gan Eden, trying to discover a meaningful existence, trying to discover real simcha, trying to connect to the Ribono Shel Olam. And that challenge, that mission, will be exceedingly difficult. And the path to that success and that fulfillment will often be obscured by the craziest of distractions and the craziest of things. And lahavdil, like the fairy tale of Hansel and Gretel, how do you make sure you lead roadmarks along the way, lishmor es derech etz hachayim, to make sure that the path to fulfillment and the path to simcha is never, ever fully obscured. Says Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu leave? He leaves Keruvim. Very quickly for now, Keruvim are insights, moments of intense spirituality, where a person says there is something of a spiritual nature in this world, there is something transcendent in this world, which gives me a guiding light and a path to that which is more, to that which is metaphysical, to that which is the province of God. But for our purposes this evening, what is the second simen? What is the second breadcrumb that allows all of us to find our way back to the Ribono Shel Olam? Says Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, that is the cherev hamisapeches. That is the vulnerability and instability of life. It is the fact that every moment that we have of joy and pleasure is not guaranteed. It is the moment that we are utterly and completely dependent on the Ribono Shel Olam. The cherev hamisapeches, the necessary rotation of life's experiences, the necessary instability and vulnerability that no matter how tough we are, no matter how macho we are, no matter how scared and in denial we are, is part and parcel of the entire human experience. It's an amazing quote I saw not long ago. Maybe some of you can remind me who says it because I don't remember. But there's a notion that we have, not just in sports, but in life. This mission and this agenda, this idea, this goal that we have in learning or lahavdil in other areas of life, failure is not an option. And the quote goes that if failure is not an option, neither is success. Failure not an option is the way you talk when you don't believe, when you're trying to invent a false bravado, a facade of stability that is not truly accurate, that is not really true. Failure is an option. It's always an option. Tragedy and destruction is lurking, and that's why our greatest simcha and joy is to appreciate what we have, what we've accomplished, and the way we've done it. Yes, it is surely true that the simcha of Purim is the simcha of accomplishment, and the simcha of Purim emerges from the relationship between Av and Adar, the knowledge of the fragility in life. The machala, one of the many, but in my opinion, especially over these past 10 months or so, the machala of our generation is to take so much for granted, is the fact that we do not acknowledge the brachos and joys that we have. We are incomplete for good or bad reason, either because of our strength and accomplishments or because of our weaknesses and insecurity. We are in complete denial of our vulnerability, of human fragility. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says there is a cherev hamisapeches. It is there l'shmor es derech etz chayim. We don't daven the way that we should. That's because we are not sensitive to the cherev hamesapeches. It doesn't have to be frightening. It could be a source of enormous comfort. A person sits in a base avel, and the cherev hamesapeches means that there is more going on. But if you experience great joy, the joy is heightened and intensified by the notion and appreciation that it doesn't have to be this way. That I am so fortunate to be able to have the opportunity to dance with Chaverim. The simplest pleasures in life are the deepest, holiest, and greatest pleasures in life. I don't need an amusement park, and I don't need a chavaya, and I don't need the eye-opening experience of a lifetime. But I walk into a Beis Medrash, and I dance around with Chaverim, and there's a Rebbe who I respect, who cares about me, who I can go hand in hand with and experience the joy, the simcha of Purim with, and I can be the happiest person in the world. It's Begeder Ezu Asher HaSameach B'chelko, a person who appreciates what he has, a person who invests in the brachos that he makes every day to contemplate and to think about. I am exceedingly, exceedingly fortunate. I am so lucky to have the opportunities that I have. That the world consists of danger and the world consists of vulnerability, and those things conspire not to depress me, not to keep me down, but to inspire me and to have me achieve the most intense levels of simcha and happiness imaginable. Kishem shemishenichnas av mimatim besimcha. In the same way that the cherev hamesapeches rears its head and the vulnerability exists, that is what allows me. So too, that is what allows me to connect to the simcha of Purim in the most meaningful of ways possible. To remember the things that have been lost, the challenges that we've had, what we've overcome, and shechiyanu v'kimanu v'igiyanu l'zman hazeh, that we are standing as an am and as individuals. We have the opportunity to learn Torah Hashem in Eretz HaKadosha. We have the most remarkable of opportunities. We have the most remarkable of brachas. So how dare we run through a bracha, run through a tefillah, or not take advantage of the deepest levels of Mishenichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha. So these are all certainly connected, but notions of what the Gemara means in that connection and in that bridge. Kishem, that simcha is not a choose-your-own-adventure, but particular ways of manifesting it and its absence, the simple pshat in the Gemara. The idea that Rav Karelenstein suggests, the beautiful idea that the month of Adar, the darkest moment of our lives, being transformed, finding our personal things of accomplishment, the transformations of dark to light that make up what Adar is, what Adar was in the story, and what Purim is. Rav Chaim Friedlander's beautiful idea regarding Betzesi Mimitzrayim, Betzesi Yushalayim, the notion of the common denominator of Hashkocha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and connection to God, Kishem Shemavarchem La'atom Mavarchem Al-Ara, and using that idea as a springboard to the revolution, the Tupshatim in revolution, the revolution of Sodom, something is changed, destroyed, and never be again, and the constant state of flux that exists in this world, which heightens our dependency on HaKadosh Baruch Hu and our feelings of deep simcha and appreciation for the many, many brachos that we have. Purim is such a special, special day. And I end with what I began, the incredible bracha, the recognition of the opportunity we have, a unique opportunity in our lives to spend it in a day, in a way that is maximum Kedusha, that connects to all of the Torah of Elul, and the Torah that we learned throughout Chorev Zman, and the Torah that we've been learning in the Beis Medrash, all building up to a day of enormous avoda, enormous holiness, and most certainly, enormous, enormous simcha, when we take stock of what we have, when we appreciate the things we have, when we escape for a few moments the nefarious clutches of magiali and taking for granted all of the things that we've been given in life. We don't look at what we lack, we look at what we have, and we celebrate together for the good fortune that we have and the opportunities we have to be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim in the future. We should have a great, great Purim and enjoy the rest of the evening.